Publishing Talk, the podcast about the book industry. I'm David Wilk, your host, and today I'm talking to Lena Tabori, who is the founder and CEO of Welcome Books. Hi, Lena. How are you?
Hey, David. Hi. Great.
Good to talk to you today.
Me too.
I think you've been in the book business quite a long time, and I think a lot of people know you, but I wonder if you could talk a little bit about your history and, you know, how you started and what you did before Welcome Books, which has been quite a bit. And then maybe talk a little bit about what Welcome Books does.
Sure, sure. You know, I guess I should go. I should just go back a little bit. I came to New York when I was 8 years old. I was a child born in Sweden, and my mother came first to America when I was three, and we lived in Los Angeles. But when we moved to New York, we lived around the corner from a man named Leo Lerman. Leo Lerman was a consultant for Cy Newhouse at Condé Nast. He was kind of the cultural czar a little bit over there. He was an extraordinary, large, rumpled, friendly, divine man, and he had an incredible library. My parents were extremely cultured themselves. My stepfather at that point was a playwright and very brilliant and introduced me to Kafka and Shakespeare long before I learned about it in school, and Andre Malraux, and I read, you know, fairly broadly because of him. When he entered my life when I was eight, the first thing he did for my brother and myself was to create a contest every week where we had to memorize a poem, which was as bizarre in my life as anything had been up to that point in time. But so he was a huge influence, but Leo Lerman was also a huge one because his library was an art library primarily, and a photography library as well. And I used to go there Saturday mornings from the time I was 12, you know, more or less. And I would just sit and read. And that's where I fell in love with Van Gogh and Matisse, and particularly those two. And, you know, in fact, I ended up painting my mother's basement in Matisse colors as a result of my Matisse experience. So I was very influenced by the aesthetics, I would say, of art. And I was very influenced by the ideas of writers from my father. So I just want to start out by saying that I think that when somebody, you know, gets involved in publishing to the degree that I have, where I've really spent my whole life there, it really comes because there's some extraordinary early influences, you know, that support and allow, you know, that experience to happen. So,
and yours was, you know, maybe particularly pointed in that way, and, you know, quite unusual, I would say.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Maybe. I mean, it was my life, you know.
Right.
I, you know, as a three-year-old sipping lemonade in the back of my house in Tarzana, California, I was fairly convinced that every three-year-old had exactly the same life that I had. So, you know, I think it takes a good while as you grow up to recognize that, you know, your life is different from other people's lives. When I was at school in Dalton, in New York, you know, it amazed me when I would go to dinner at somebody else's house and they would serve ice water at the table. You know, that kind of sort of, in a way, a sort of an upper class kind of behavior didn't exist in my house. You know, my house was a very freewheeling, bohemian, artistic house. It just, so, you know, if you wanted water for dinner, which nobody ever did, you would get up and get that, you know. Nobody served it to you. So, you know, but the one thing that, you know, everybody did serve was an unbelievable amount of really exciting, interesting conversation all the time about everything that was going on. I remember my father being utterly appalled when the New York Herald Tribune decided that they would have sort of a little digest of the news that was going to be in the newspaper running down the left-hand side of the front page of the paper. He said, "Oh my God, now we're going to have instant news," you know, and that was a shocking concept to him. But in any case, I mean, I had an extraordinary upbringing, and I didn't realize it most of the time, but you know, at some point, of course, I got a grip, and I understood that I grew up differently than, or in many ways differently than other people did. But you know, the first job I got, I had at Delacorte Press. My mother had a secretary that would come after her work hours. She was the secretary for Ross Claiborne, who was the editor in chief of Delacorte, and one of the two, actually. Helen Meyer had brilliantly broken up the hardcover line that they had decided to start amongst the two editors of her softcover lines. They had a Dell line, and then they had a Delta laurel leaf and sort of a kind of trade paperback side, and she decided to start a hardcover line, and she gave it to both Don Fine and Ross Claiborne, who, of course, and this will describe my first observation of publishing, they just duked it out. it was like creating, you know, the battle between Cain and Abel. But in any case, the secretary of Ross, who was also working now part-time for my mother at night, used to say that she was overwhelmed by the lack of efficiency in the filing room in her office, and you know, wouldn't I please devote some of those hours that I just spent walking around the bridle path in the park to coming over and trying to organize that room for them. So I was at Sarah Lawrence at the time, and I did exactly what she asked. It was, you know, this closed 8-foot by 8-foot room that was just nothing but file cabinets. And the information in the file cabinets went back to 1929 or 1930, when I suppose they first started getting involved in some form or another of publishing. And I read every single document as I reorganized that file room. So by the end of it, which was like 3 months, I think I must have spent in there, I knew more about, you know, the history of that publishing company than almost anybody that worked there. And the thing of it that I fell most in love with were the writer's reports. You know, there were people like Sally Delfridge and Nora Sayer and these marvelous people who used to write for $25 a report on a manuscript that was being submitted to Delacorte. And I thought, I can do that. And so I started just picking up, you know, they had this massive pile of submissions that didn't come through agents, and it was called the, I don't know what it was called, but it was like this pile that nobody paid any attention to, really. And they would clean it out once a month, but it would, you know, for the period of time, it would just sit at the end of the editorial department, and if anybody wanted to dig through it, they could. And so I would dig, you know, in there, and I would write reports on all kinds of things that I found. And Earl Shores was my big discovery. I was mad crazy about Earl Shores. He'd written this manuscript where he had this quote right at the beginning which said, "Me caigo en las botas de la Virgen," which is, "I shit in the boots of the Virgin." And I just loved it, you know, I just loved it. And anyway, he's now, you know, he's a huge published author with Norton, but Richard Kennedy, one of the editors that I ended up working for at Delacorte when I finally took a real job there, after I left Sarah Lawrence, was his editor for a bit, and I don't know. Anyway, it was very, that, you know, so that was the beginning. I mean, Delacorte for me was the beginning. I started cleaning out files, and I ended up being an assistant, and then one of my editors that I was assisting, and assisting, by the way, you know, that meant, you know, buying the frozen beef bourguignon for Richard's cocktail parties and seeing to it that nobody caught him, well, forget that. Anyway, right. There was a lot of jobs that went along with being an assistant other than doing actual work for the department that I sort of thought was curious, but nonetheless. And then one of my editors went to Abrams, and when he left to go to Abrams at a time when I had taken a couple of weeks off to go to London, where my father had written a screenplay that was being produced in London by John Heyman, who happens to be the father of David Heyman, who's produced all the Harry Potter movies, just, you know, as an aside. And Mia Farrow was in the film that was being shot there, and she at that time had just cut her hair extremely short, which I had done as well, And she had also been rumored to be separating from Frank Sinatra and not in very good, she wasn't very happy at the time. So I thought, well, why don't I go over there and do an interview with her? You know, one of the businesses of Bell and Delacorte and that particular company of Helen Myers at the time was Modern Screen Magazine and a number of other magazines that sort of related to that. And I was had gotten kind of friendly with the guy, Richard Heller, who ran those magazines, and I said, you know, if I can get an interview with Mia Farrow, would you run it? And he said yes, because I had been writing for him anyway under the name of Harriet Schwab, just doing things out of his files, which I found kind of interesting and fun to do. So I called my father and I said, what do you think? And he said, well, she's not doing any interviews with anybody. And so I thought, well, maybe I'll just go and see if, because I'm with my father who's there, I can manage to achieve this. But I didn't think I should go without calling up, you know, a friend of mine who was a photographer and seeing if he wanted to come too. So I did that, and he had an agent, and the agent called Ladies' Home Journal, and the next thing I knew, I was about to get on the flight, but I was first stopping at the Ladies' Home Journal office, and the guy who was running Ladies' Home Journal sort of pointed this great big finger at me and said, what makes you think you can do this, and what makes you think you can do that, and what makes you think you can accomplish this? And I just got behind my chair, and I said, okay. I said, fire away. You know, you can't hit me now. And I was just bizarre enough for him to think that I might actually get the interview. And I did. And so that was sort of the beginning of a little bit of my writing thing, too. And I also got sort of an insight into the way magazines worked, which I didn't really have any idea of. I mean, I was young, for God's sake, David. I was really young at that point in time. Anyway, by the time I got back to New York from having been there, this editor had gone to Harry Abrams and called me up and said, look, you know, he's got this job doing an illustrated medical encyclopedia for Harry Abrams, but he's sure that he's going to have other things that are going to be more interesting, and wouldn't I come over and be his assistant? And I thought, for twice the salary, I was making $85 a week, he was offering me $160, I thought, absolutely, you know, and I just leapt. And of course, the second I was at Harry Abrams, I realized this was like being a Leo Lerman, except better, because not only did I have the opportunity to sit and read, I had the most extraordinary contemporary art collection on the walls everywhere. I mean, Harry had, you know, done nothing with, I mean, he'd sold a greeting card business in 1949 to Hallmark, and he took the money and bought paintings, and they were everywhere. I mean, he had what he bought in France, the Impressionist works and so forth, he had at home, but in the office he had contemporary American art, and I simply fell off the shelf. I was just impassioned. I had a Wesselman hanging over my desk that lit up, a nude, blonde, incredibly buxom woman that was divine. I had Rosenquist and Frankenthalers, and it was just, I don't know, it was an atmosphere that I craved and fell totally in love with. And I worked for this wonderful editor for, I don't know, maybe 2 months. And then Harry Abrams called me into his office and said, well, you've accomplished so much in 2 months that I think you need to do something else. And what do you want to do? I thought, well, I don't know, but I mean, this company has no... there's nobody marketing it, you know. There's nobody telling the world about what's going on here. There's no, what I learned later was called a public relations office. You know, I didn't know anything about a public relations office at the time, but that's what they didn't have. And so he said, well, why don't you start talking to newspapers? And I said, okay. I said, I have no idea how to do that. And he said, well, let me give you some help. And I'll send you over to Bernie Geis's publicist, and I'll send you over to The husband of the woman who's doing our Shell book, Shell 500 Million Years of Inspired Design, because that's what he used to do. He was a public relations guy. And you'll learn something. So I went and met Letty Pokrobin, who's a legend in the business, at Bernie Geis's. And she was spent a lot of time in this interview on the telephone. She had twins at home, and she was talking to the babysitter a good bit of the time. But in between, she would say things to me like, oh, you've got a Salvador Dali book coming up. Why don't you do a melted plastic watch to give away at BEA? Or, you know, this was the woman who did the prescription pads for Valley of the Dolls, you know, as her PR. I mean, the woman was a genius, really, in what she did. But in my opinion, loving the interview and loving meeting her, but in my opinion, the ideas that she had weren't, what shall I say? They weren't classy enough. They weren't sort of upgrade enough. They weren't elegant enough. That's the best way to put it. They weren't elegant enough for Abrams. So, but nonetheless, it was an extraordinary, you know, it was once again, it was a window into a world that I hadn't experienced before. And I guess, I don't know, you know, maybe the most exciting thing about being young is being allowed to sort of discover that there are all these worlds that you would never have had any idea about. I always think it's fascinating when people say to very young kids, you know, what are you going to do with your life? And they say, well, they're going to be a fireman or a policeman. You know, it's like something that they can observe. But of course, what happens when you get into the real world is that there are all these extraordinary things that people do that you don't observe from the outside in that same way. And they get really, really interesting. Anyway, that was fascinating to me, the whole experience of doing public relations, of sitting down with an editor of a newspaper or a producer for a television show and talking about a project from the perspective of how it would work for them. Finding your way over to their side, understanding what they needed and what they wanted and what their challenges were, and seeing if you could meet those challenges with what you had to bring. That, David, was really the beginning of my publishing career.
Well, it's interesting, too, that describes what I think what a lot of people say today is the new way of marketing online, which is kind of ironic because what you're indicating is that's nothing, there's nothing new about that. That's what PR people have really been doing for a long time, which is find out what the other person wants and see if your thing can appeal to them.
Absolutely.
In a lot of ways, that's really what publishing is about.
Absolutely. That's why I say it was the beginning of my publishing career, really, because once I understood how capable it turned out I was to make that translation to somehow. I mean, I actually think that one of the biggest problems of the internet is that you don't have that face to face. You know, so you have to work from a different clue set. You know, I think what I was really, really good at doing was in meeting a person, I got them very, very fast, you know. And a lot of getting somebody is not just reading them, but hearing them and seeing them and interacting with them.
Right, which has made, you know, the intermediation of the web is that you have access to people, hundreds and millions of, thousands and millions of people, but not personal access in the way that you can get it with face-to-face or even telephone.
Correct. I think, in thinking about that just at this moment, I think there's, you know, I was trained as a child to be very responsive to situations, which I guess is true for every child. I guess that's not something that was just true for me. I think for any child to survive, whatever their circumstances are, they have to be keenly conscious of their surroundings and how to manipulate through them. That would be, let's say, most extreme for a child. in, you know, Warsaw, Poland during the Second World War, where they would really have to get a grip on what was going on or they might literally not survive. And it would be least significant for a child that grows up in a very secure, comfortable, safe family where everybody listens to everybody else's feelings and pays attention. But somewhere in between is where most of us grew up. And to the degree that there was danger in our lives in whatever form, it honed our survival senses. And I think that served me incredibly well when I was doing what I was doing, because I learned to understand what people needed very early on in my life. And I learned that I had a lot of ability to speak to where they lived, as it were. Anyway, that was good for me. So that, you know, Harry moving me out of research, which is what I was doing for my editor, and into an interactive sort of people situation was brilliant for me. And, you know, years later when I was the publisher of Stuart Tabori and Chang and I was interviewing somebody who was coming in to be a customer service person, and, you know, they had graduated from the Columbia School of Journalism and they had high hopes for their life and the customer service wasn't what they were thinking they were going to be doing. And I said, you have no idea where you are going to become a publisher from. You can't... It can be from anywhere. You know, if you are a customer service person, you are going to learn more than any other person in this company exactly what's right and wrong with every single book that you're doing. You're going to learn what satisfies the bookstore and what doesn't. You're going to learn whether the cover, you know, scruffs because of the way it was designed more than anybody. You're going to learn a huge amount of stuff. It doesn't mean you're going to stay in customer service for the rest of your life. You're just going to take the knowledge, and when you get to the point of feeling like you've absorbed all the knowledge that that particular position provides you with, you are then going to look around and say, where's the next place that I need knowledge from in order to get to the next place that I want to go to? Now, I know it sounds fairly manipulative, but I think actually it is the way the world works. It's like you satisfy yourself with what a situation can offer you, and then if you're hungry, you look for more. That's what happened in school. You know, you learn as much as you need to learn in third grade, and then you go to fourth grade. It's not an unusual situation, and it's pretty much the way, you know, if I kind of look at my life, it's kind of, I moved around, you know, from sort of place to place within Abrams, actually. I mean, Abrams was a place that I was at home. Harry Abrams was an unbelievable mentor for me. I mean, he thought that I walked on water, and it didn't matter whatsoever whether I did or not. His very thinking that I did gave me, you know, this massive confidence to go forward in a world that I didn't know anything about time and time again. And I would discover that, you know, somehow or another I would muddle through. And that was really great experience because it gave me kind of, I don't know, it gave me a sense of, being able to achieve. And I think, you know, if you have that, you have more than most people. Really.
Well, I think what you've described, I mean, there's two things you've described there. One is the importance of when you're whatever it is you're trying to be, whether it's publisher or anything, you have to learn what the business is and you have to learn who the people are before you can do whatever it is you're trying to do, which is something I think, you know, I think people forget because we don't have a tradition any as deeply held a tradition of essentially apprenticeship as used to exist. And the other thing you hit, I think, is that having someone believe in you and tell you that you can do things is really an effective way of leading. You know, that's, again, you know, there are different styles of leadership all over the place, but I tend to think that you can help people be great by simply believing in them and allowing them to be great. So you obviously benefited tremendously by having someone, and Harry Abrams was a pretty great guy to have do this for you, believe in you in a way that enabled you to believe in yourself.
Yes, I think a great deal of life is luck, David. You know, I was very lucky. I had an incredible person in him. And, you know, that was just, everybody always wants to know, you know, what the ingredients of success are, and a great deal of the time people think it just has to do with the person's native abilities and, you know, talents and so forth. And I certainly think, you know, you can't really make a publisher. They have to have it in a certain sense. They have to have it in a certain sense. But obviously experience then tacks onto that, and luck tacks onto that. And those things all combine, you know, to provide opportunities that allow both that native gift and the experiences that come along to come together. And it's also about a point in time, you know. It's like my greatest, the time of my greatest, let's say, rise in some, my greatest growth within publishing, both personally and professionally, was really in my late 20s and 30s. I mean, those were extraordinary, meteoric kind of years for me. And I think that had an enormous amount to do with the fact that there were unbelievably few women of any huge significance. I mean, Helen Meyer, when I worked at Delacorte, I think she was the only woman who ran a publishing company at that time. And, you know, if I looked around during my period for mentors, you know, I would look, Letty Pokerman, as I said, you know, she was a fairly significant person, and, you know, Joni Evans was kind of around. It was an industry that was run by men primarily. I mean, there were women editors who were amazing, but the business was run by men, and everybody always used to say that, you know, you would have to be in the subsidiary rights part of the business in order to come to the attention of anybody, upstairs in terms of, you know, your own potential gifts, because if you didn't generate money for the company, then you were a worker bee, pretty much. And so I just was there at a good point. You know, I was there at a good point in time. And Harry wasn't threatened by women, but he was completely threatened by men. So consequently, he did battle with all the men that worked with him, and he made certain that none of them really were able to grow very far. They either quit at some point or they were fired. And I was just free to fly, you know, within that firm. So I think there's a lot of luck that plays a role. Anyway, it was great for me because over a period of years, I started to develop. I did, of course, public relations for a long time, and then I started also adding special sales to that equation, which was indeed very, very helpful and important for the growth of Abrams. They were owned by Times Mirror at a certain point in all of this, and that was, you know, that was not irrelevant, obviously. So that was great. And then I started creating, out of the special sales division that I ended up having, I started creating a lot of books for them. So, you know, normally books are all developed in the editorial department of companies, but in Harry's company it was so freewheeling in some sense that lots of things could happen from lots of places. And as long as you didn't step on anybody else's toes, you know, you were kind of free to do many things. And so, you know, I developed books that didn't require what the editorial department had to offer. I did the Norman Rockwell Christmas book, and I did Carol Beckwith's Masai book, and I ended up working very deeply on gnomes, which became, you know, huge. And I gravitated towards, I don't know, what could you say? I used to have these extraordinary discussions with this absolutely brilliant executive vice president that we had, who used to say to me, Lina, he would say, he came from Europe very early on in the Second World War, to have this marvelous deep accent, and he would say, if the boat is going down, what book is Lina going to save? And Lina would say, well, it's not going to be early Netherlandish painting. It might have to be Miss Piggy, or it might have to be, you know, I simply gravitated towards books where I could really find a big audience. And it wasn't that I wanted to deal with projects that were of limited, profound interest. It's just that there was, you know, there was that public relations piece of me that just adored seeing the results of something in a very big way.
Well, I have to interrupt you a little bit because we're sort of running out of time, and I didn't want to forget a couple of things to ask you about. Today, Welcome Books is what you're doing, and
yeah.
it's you know, definitely a continuation of everything you've talked about here with wonderful books and incredible, in some cases, what I think are just incredibly rich and beautiful creations. Maybe just talk for a couple of minutes about what your vision of publishing is today and how you feel that it's, you know, you're living that with Welcome Books, and what you think will happen over the next few years.
Well, you know, it's a curious thing. We do art and photography books, basically. It's always illustrated, everything. And we create books that are objects in many ways. So there's lots and lots of elements, whether it's gatefolds or silk screens or teeny books within big books, or, you know, there's just all kinds of things that we're searching for all the time that we feel are appropriate to that particular subject that excite us and interest us. Right now, of course, electronic books are limited to PDFs of pages. That's going to change very swiftly, and the iPad is going to start the change. And the change that is interesting me most about what opportunity it's providing are the linkage potentials. So that, you know, where books are right now limited by how fast or how slow you turn a page, that limitation will immediately disappear when you can link out of a page into some piece of, you know, more obscure or more, or let's say sidebars. Let's just look at them as sidebars. You're going to be able to go in and out of books. You're going to be able to divert and distract yourself, and then you can come back if you wish, or you can stay distracted and lost out there somewhere in the Netherlands. But so I guess what excites me about what is going to happen is how quickly and, you know, they are going to, the electronic piece of the business is going to embrace not just the linear book side of what is the majority, of course, of the book business, the linear book side, but is going to embrace the books that can take you anywhere and everywhere. Are they ever going to be able to reproduce visual imagery as exquisitely as we can do in a book? I don't think so. You know, our kind of books, as long as there is going to be still a forum for people to be able to see them, as long as there are going to be bookstores around where people can walk in and touch them, I think the touchability of what we're doing is so extreme and so special and so superb and so appropriate for the particular subject. You know, it's going to be a long, long time before that changes. But the interactivity is going to so suit my fascination with every place that anything can take you. I mean, I'm now writing for the Huffington Post sometimes, and I love the research I do on the linkage. It's as much fun and as much interest as anything else I do. I guess, you know, we're gonna see. I'm buying the iPad, of course, immediately, because although I was utterly uninterested in the Kindle, I'm completely interested in all the directions that the iPad can take you. And I think that we will end up doing something very extraordinary in that realm with projects that are built specifically for that. Projects that weren't built specifically for that, I mean, the idea of simply folding something into another form because another form exists, unless it in some way enhances and enlarges the experience, makes it a better, more exhilarating experience, I don't really see the point.
I think you're right about that. I think we're at a kind of pivotal point where the idea of simply converting print books to e-forms is going to change, and I think that's really, you know, a very exciting opportunity for publishers to
absolutely,
you know, and for readers. I think that, you know, really what it's going to be about ultimately is the reading experience, and I think it's not about replacing the written page or the printed page. It's about adding another experience to the portfolio for publishers and for readers. So I think you're right about that. I think what we should do is plan another conversation after the iPad's been out a while, and then we can revisit and see whether the things that you're interested in today will be the same or different. I really want to thank you, Lena, for talking to me today. It's been a pleasure. It's David Wilk talking to Lena Tabori. This has been Publishing Talks, a podcast about the book industry. Thanks so much.